His was a memorable, if tempestuous, career with more than its fair share of highs and lows. It began in South Melbourne, ended at Carlton, and took in Sydney in between. In the end, it afforded him 182 games in total, 106 of them at Carlton, and a premiership medallion and Norm Smith medal to show for it. Known on a first-name basis with Tribunal Chairman Neil Bissey, he's fondly remembered here at Carlton as the blonde in the number 26 Guernsey, known simply as Reece. I'm, of course, speaking of the one and only David Rees-Jones, today's very special guest, and we welcome him now. Reece, how's things?
Very good. There was never a dull moment, was there, Beast?
Absolutely, Reece. We will get to that that excitement of your career very soon, but we need to really set up the early story. And I wanted to, first of all, ask you about your origins, your family history. Was there a sporting pedigree in your family? Was Dad a footballer in his own right? And what can you tell us about those early days, your formative years as growing up as a footballer?
Yeah, look, Dad was he was a very good footballer. You know, played in the ruck as he's probably 6'1", I suppose. And back in those days, he was reasonably tall and skinny and lanky. And from all reports, he was a pretty good footballer around the suburbs and that. And he did get invited down to South Melbourne. He lived in Albert Park to play with them, but he was actually getting paid more to play local footy than what he would have got playing for South Melbourne. So and he was a Carlton supporter, I suppose. So you know, that sort of was a bit of a tie-in as well. But I don't think he wanted to play against Carlton.
Was he a winger, Reece, and was he a feisty character on the field?
Yeah, no. From what I gather, and obviously I didn't see my dad play, but from what I've been told, he was a pretty fair type of footballer. So. No, it wasn't his fault, put it that way. But we'll get into that later.
And mum was a sports person in her own right? Did she involve herself in sports as a young woman or not?
Oh, a little bit. There wasn't much for women back in those days. She used to play a bit of tennis and stuff and got involved in that side of things, more on a social aspect than everything. But she was heavily involved in, you know, I've played most of my junior football with the Oakley Youth Club Football Club, which is now the Oakley Dragons. And both mum and dad were life members of the club with the, you know, amount of time and effort that they put in, whether it be in the canteen or setting things up or dad, you know, getting the smoke nights going or whatever. But, they were great times and, definitely had a big influence on my football.
And was there backyard footy at your house or, you know, a roll-up pair of socks being kicked around the bedroom? What did you...
There's a bit of everything. I mean, the old plastic footy when we're, you know, 3 or 4 years old, we would be getting kicked around the backyard. And I had a brother who was a year older, and he barracked for Carlton and I barracked for Richmond. So back in the late 60s, early 70s, Richmond-Carlton were pretty fierce matches, and it was pretty fierce in the backyard too. So,
Now, David, you crossed from Oakley Districts as a junior player and joined the Swans, played senior footy, I think, from 1980 through to 84. It was a hell of a transition for you, coming from, you know, the back blocks as a kid straight into the cut and thrust of league footy.
Yeah, look, I was a 17-year-old kid. I was about 10 and a half stone, ringing wet at that stage. And, I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to play, you know, for South Melbourne back in those days. For people who can remember South Melbourne, I was fortunate enough to be given an opportunity there and as a 17-year-old and played senior footy in my first year, yeah.
And it was Greg Miller that got you across?
Yeah, Greg was part of the recruiting, or he's heading up the recruiting process. And, I got invited down to a Kazali day at Waverley, at VFL Park Waverley, and... teams from South Melbourne's four areas played against each other. Anthony Danaher was, there are a few good guys. I think Dennis Carroll is involved with the Wagga team and Brett Scott and a few others. And I was with the local eastern suburbs part of it. So I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to train with the seniors in the early stages of pre-season training, and I went from there.
And you learned a lot from your time at South Melbourne / Sydney, and do you still have a deep affinity for the place?
For the
Swans?
Yeah, probably not so much. I was disappointed in the way it all finished, I suppose, with the Swans, and And, you know, I mean, while you're playing, you don't want to leave a club, but I felt like I was in a position where I was forced to leave. So, I was happy to see them, you know, win a couple of flags over the last few years. But and good on them. I think they've got great character. And, you know, it was a hard battle up there for a long, long time. And the Swans, you know, at various times, you know, looked like they weren't going to continue on. So for what they've been able to turn it around is a credit to the people involved these days.
David, you joined Carlton from the Swans in 1985. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that led to you leaving the Swans?
Yeah, look, I mean, at the time, I didn't want to leave Sydney and, you know, I was established up there and looking, I suppose, in that next year to probably put a deposit down the house and do a few things. But the AFL, in their wisdom, I suppose, at the time, sacked quite a number of the administration Swans people. I mean, Dean Moore was one of them. Greg Miller was another. And these were the type of people we trusted, you know, when we were moving up there. And you know, they were our mentors, and Greg obviously recruited me. So you placed a bit of faith in them. And when they were sacked and they put basically some VFL cronies in up there, I suppose, and... you know, I mean, it was tough times. They called us in. The first meeting they had with us, they said that anyone who was getting a rise in their contract for the next year wouldn't be getting it. Everyone would be on the same salary as they were the year before. And so I spoke to them afterwards, and I said, "What? That's right across the board." And they said, "Yep, that's across the board. There'll be no players." You know, I said, "Well, look, I've got another year of my contract to run, and I can go elsewhere and get paid double what you won't pay me," sort of thing. So I said, "This is ridiculous." And I was lucky enough that my manager, when I moved to Sydney, you know, I'd just signed a 3-year contract, put a clause in there stating that if I demanded my money after the season and wasn't paid within 30 days, then my contract became null and void. And I knew the Swans didn't have any money, so we enacted that. And they didn't pay me within the 30 days. So basically, I was a free agent. Even though I had a year on my contract to go, I could walk straight out of my contract and go wherever I wanted. And I spoke to him. He said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, look, I want to talk to some clubs in Melbourne." And the two clubs I was thinking of at the time, because, I mean, if you're going to leave a club, I always thought, well, I want to go to one that, you know, you're going to play in a premiership. I hadn't played any finals footy. I'd watched it every year. I'd, you know, been in the system 5 years and was starting to make a bit of a name for myself. And so Hawthorn and Carlton were the two teams who I asked him to sort of, you know, gauge if there's any interest or not. And there was interest from both of them, but Hawthorn had a different pay structure to Carlton. So it was... it basically got down to dollars and cents in the end, and Hawthorn, look, they had a great, you know, I mean, it was probably the greatest era of a club, and I was thinking about going there, but went to Carlton for the money.
And I've heard of the different pay structures, because I understand that at Hawthorn the brown paper bags were slightly smaller than the Carlton bags.
Well, no, I didn't even see the brown paper bag, but what happened was they basically... And how it was explained to me was Lee Matthews was the captain. He was the highest paid. And they'd put you in the pecking order where they saw, you know, and so everyone was paid on how they saw your value to the team and that. And I was thinking, that doesn't sound very promising. What happens if an injury or suspension or something, which obviously occurred to me a fair bit. So, Carlton was the one option. I went down, I spoke to Ian Collins and Keith McKenzie on a Saturday morning, flew into Melbourne, straight down there, spoke to them. At the end of that meeting, I said, "Well, look," I said, "it's all right for you guys to say, you know, you want me to come and everything, but I'd like to hear it from the coach as well," who was David Parkin at the time. They organised David Parkin to see me that afternoon. So, you know, I was pretty impressed with that and actually signed a contract that afternoon. So,
Do you remember where you met David Parkin and what he actually said in that conversation?
It was in St Kilda Road somewhere. It was an office or something in St Kilda Road. I'm not too sure if my accountant had organised it or whether Colo had organised it or what had happened there, but I'm pretty sure it was an office in St Kilda Road, and we met there in the morning and then went away and then come back and met at the same place in the afternoon. And I spoke to Parko for a while, and he seemed convinced that, you know, I'd be a good fit for his team and so forth, and... yeah, went from there. And I didn't want to get involved in any protracted bidding wars. You know, I didn't want to speak to anyone else. So I just signed the contract and that was done and dusted then and there.
In retrospect, in your life, how highly does that rate in terms of one of the best decisions you've made?
Oh, look, no doubt it was it was a decision that, look, with footy, I didn't want to be seen to be a mercenary type of person. And I left through principles. I mean, as I said, I had a year of a contract to go in Sydney. And but, you know, I wasn't being treated the way I should have been treated. I was willing to abide by my end of that contract. And the people I appointed at the club then weren't prepared to abide by that. So, to me, that, you know, that was an easy move to make. And the move to Carlton was, once again, I mean, I could have put myself up and spoke to every club in the league and gone to the highest bidder. But, no, I preferred to just, you know, I don't know. I didn't want to put that added pressure on, although coming to Carlton actually put a lot of pressure on anyway. So, you know, obviously they want a success.
And I dare say your father would have cracked open the Verve Clico, being a great Carlton man. He would have been over the moon with that.
I don't know about the Verve Clico, but a long neck, I reckon he would have had at that stage.
Now, David, we've spoken about the Sydney connection. We talk about Carlton now. Again, when you walked into Carlton, 1985, Princess Park as it was then, first impressions, what was your view of the place and how did you find it?
Oh, look, I mean, you walk in, you can almost smell the success of the place. You know, you see the greats on the wall, the, you know, Jezelenko, Dool, who was still playing, Nichols, you know, Southby, just champions right through, you know. And you just knew it was a special place. You know, it just reeked of success. And there was expectations, I mean, very high expectations, which I hadn't really come across at South Melbourne or the Swans. I mean, we could play a team such as Carlton or an Essendon back in those days and get beat by a couple of points, and your supporters would be cheering you off the ground. They'd be happy that you run a good team to a couple of points. And that didn't sit great with me. I mean, I wanted to win and wanted to be successful. So it was a different kettle of fish coming down to Carlton, where you could have had 15 injuries and just doesn't matter. The 20 who pull that navy blue Guernsey on are expected to win.
Of course, timing is everything. You're at the right place, right time, as a lot of Carlton players of your era were. 86 was obviously a disappointment. You know, it's often said you have to take a step backward to take a couple forward. What were your recollections of the experience of playing in the 1986 grand final, just of running out and being a part of that day, and what did you learn from that game that put you in good stead for the following year?
Oh, look, I played on Gary Ayres that day, so he won the Norm Smith medal. So I remember the Mad Monday, and all the boys were calling me Smithy all day, so because Ayres, he won the Norm Smith medal, so I had to wear that for the course of Mad Monday. But that was part and parcel of it, and you got to grin and bear it. But look, I think we had a pretty young team. We had a lot of guys, Kernahan, Bradley, Motley, who'd just come over from South Australia having their first year. I think Dorotich was in his first year at the club. And it was, a lot of us had never played on that big stage, been on that big stage before. So it was, and while we had some guys who, you know, we had some triple premiership players, and I think Dooley had played in 4 or 5 or whatever. So, you know, we had a mix there, but it definitely, the next year we're better prepared and knew what it was all about.
And of course, you had that extra incentive, I think, you know, with the accident to Peter Motley. Des English was battling cancer. And, of course, Bernie Evans, your old mate, missed out on the one crack at the flag.
Yeah. Got rubbed
best
out.
Best player field in the second semi. Can you talk about those three, the influence that those three players had on your preparations for that season and the premiership?
I quite often you look at it and you might see it might be the Olympics or it might be a big event, and you'll see someone and they dedicate it to someone who wasn't there. You know, it might have been a father who passed away during the course of the year, who inspired him along the way or whatever. And you quite often, and I've got no doubt that those, you know, Des, you know, contracting cancer, Mott's had his serious accident, and Bernie, as you mentioned, was a good mate of mine. Who we had three of our comrades who couldn't be out there with us, basically, and I got no doubt that that was in the back of everyone's mind, you know, on that particular day, and just that steely resolve was there that we weren't going to let them down. As much as, you know, we didn't want to let ourselves and our supporters and everyone else down, it was probably that little bit extra you needed, that little 1% that you just needed to just concentrate and do, you know, do the job over 100 minutes of footy. And, yeah, it definitely played a huge part.
And you've been on the receiving end of a lot of unfortunate tribunal penalties, but I dare say you would even admit that, you know, the two-match penalty meted out to Burnie was the cruelest penalty of all. You know, a fellow that played...
It was one match. He only got the one match. Yeah, he got the one match, and it was a grand final. And you know, so, yeah, look, you know, I'm still good mates with Burnie today, and you still feel for him, you know. I mean, and he was an enormous part. I had a pretty big, you know, interest in getting Burnie to Carlton sort of thing, and was glad when he was there because he was just... And, you know, terrific bloke, but a great clubman as much as so on and off the field. He was fantastic, Burnie, and a real presence around the club, and everyone loved him. So, you know, I think everyone was pretty disappointed that Burnie couldn't, you know, be out there for us. And obviously, you know, coming from the Swans and South Melbourne, you know, not achieving that success and being rubbed out for 1 week is it's a very harsh penalty, that is.
Absolutely. Now, it's famous, of course, your performance in 87, you know, the great showing on Dermot in that grand final, unorthodox position of centre-half back, many respects. Wolsey made the call grand final week. When did you find out? Did you have any inkling that this would be the job for you grand final day?
No, everything was pretty well normal until, you know, you walk into the room and you look on the board and see where you're playing. And, you know, I saw myself at centre-half back on Dermot, and I thought, oh, well, here's a challenge. You know, I'm either going to be best on ground or the worst on the ground. So I don't think it's going to be much of an in-between with this one. But, yeah, it's a great challenge. And I think I played a lot of my better football when I was given a challenge.
Yeah. Had you played in that position before at any stage in your career?
No, I'd gone on to the back line, you know, and played a bit across half back and so forth during the course of that year. But, yeah, it was the first time I'd sort of really played back line. So it was a bit of a risk, but it worked.
And there was no apprehension given what had happened in 86. I mean, you know, you've mentioned, you know, you probably lowered your colours to GAs that day. Were there nerves going into that game? Any apprehension at all that, oh, you know, this is going to be a tough afternoon? Or were you relishing the opportunity to atone for what had happened?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, I'd probably had a reasonable final series in 86 other than that grand final. And even looking at that game, you know, in hindsight sort of thing, there were a few times where I was in good position, but the Hawthorn pressure and that day was, you know, just meant that, you know, I wasn't the closest checking wingman or so. So he was able to get out in his own a few times, which it could have gone the other way. You know, if we had had the ball and had a bit more control of the ball, I probably would have, you know, had a bit better day that day, but that's the way footy goes, and that's, you know. But with Dermot, he was a player you had to just concentrate on and be on for that full 100 minutes because, you know, he was one of those blokes who could really turn a game of football in the space of 5 or 6 minutes, and so I had to make sure he didn't do that.
And, of course, it was a 33-34 degree day. Terrible conditions, you know, for playing, really. And I know a lot of players, you know, dehydrated. There were a few fellows laying low at the celebrations afterwards. At what stage of that game did you think you had Hawthorn?
I remember it was probably about 20 minutes into the last quarter, and we just kicked a goal, and I've sort of given a little fist pump, and yes, and Dermot turned to me and said, "You blokes won this game 10 minutes ago. You know, the game was over. You know, you basically, you know," I think he'd realised that the game was lost to them, but until you hear that final siren blow, you don't want to really, you know, especially after losing one the year before, you just don't want to let it slip. And you know, as I mentioned, you know, guys like Burton, that they can turn it on in 5 minutes and kick four or five goals and put them back in the game. So, yeah, when the siren blew, I was relieved as much as anything.
And I've heard Stephen Silvani mention a very similar story about playing or standing on Gary Ablett in the 95 grand final. You know, the game was probably over a long time before he conceded it was over because of his fear that someone like Ablett could turn the game so quickly.
Yeah, there were. There's some great players, you know, who had the ability to change the way a match was flowing. And, you know, Wayne Carey was another. I mean, there's some great players over the time who really Dacos-type, you know, great players who could just turn the game, and Dermot was one of them.
Do you believe you played better games for Carlton than that game, or do you think in retrospect that was the greatest game of football you actually played personally?
Oh, no, I think I played better games of football. I mean, the 86 second semi-final, I think I had about 34, 35 possessions or something along those lines, and I actually played on the resting Rovers in that match out on a wing and had a great game. So and hence I copped Gary Ayres the following, you know, or 2 weeks later. But that's, you know, that's part and parcel, and that was a better game, all round game of football that I played. A lot of the job in the back line, I mean, you know, I had guys like Soss and Peter Dean and Tommy Elvin and that back there, Mick Kennedy and so forth, who you know, they were probably more dour defenders than what I was. I mean, I like running around getting a kick myself and causing a bit of trouble here and there, but I didn't have to that day. So it was, it just all clicked.
Now, can you talk a little bit about receiving the Norma Smith Medal? There's a great story about that episode and the person that you actually received the medal from. What was the history there between you and the presenter of the medal?
Well, it was funny. You got to go back to round 18, 1981. It was South Melbourne versus Melbourne at the MCG, and I'd had a ripper first quarter. I probably had about 9 or 10 possessions in the first quarter on a wing, and Ron Barassi was coaching Melbourne at that stage, and I don't know whether he told someone that I need to be stopped or halted or whatever, but Brent Croswell decided about 5 minutes into the second quarter that he was going to take my head off with his knee, and I was on my hands and knees, and it's one of those ones where you're that close to being knocked out but not knocked out that you're seeing stars and you're blurred, but you know what's happening and you're not knocked out, and you get to your feet and I actually got reported, I think it was 5 times after that, and it was an all-in blue, and I was reported for kicking Croswell, striking Croswell. I was reported for hitting Crackers Keenan. I got reported 5 times in the one match, but it was all within about 10 minutes. And the last charge was hitting the runner, and the Melbourne runner that day happened to be Peter Smith, who happened to be Norm Smith's son. So I got 4 weeks for hitting the runner, and so it's ironic, isn't it, how you know.
Fast
Norm
forward.
Smith, I whacked his kid and won his medal.
And Peter presented it.
Yeah. So I think it was Bob Hawke, actually, that day. I can't remember that. But, it was all a blur after that. And while it was good to get the medal, I suppose, it was, we play a team sport. I mean, we all had to do our job on that day and to, you know, be the number one team, and that was it.
What's happened to the medal, Reece? You've got it front and centre in your house at home?
No, it's been floating around. I've moved a few times. I was divorced, and then so I was sort of packing bags and boxes and things and around it. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think I could tell you where it is at this point in time, but I'm sure it's somewhere.
Does it mean a lot to you?
The medal itself, no, but as I said, it's an individual prize. You know, we play a team sport, and not a great deal. I mean, the one thing about it, I suppose, is when you go somewhere and you get introduced and people will say the 1987 Norm Smith medalist David Rees-Jones, you know, rather than the bloke who got reported 25 times, and you know, I would have just been that mug who got reported 25 times otherwise. So at least I got, you know, people can know that I could play football as well.
And I dare say you do have a premiership medallion, which you probably treasure more.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, that's what you play footy for. That's, you know, but at the end of the day, I mean, the medals themselves, I'm not even too sure if they're probably worth about $10 each to make back in those days. But they don't take your name out of the book, so, yeah.
And they're very hard to win, that's for sure. On a completely different matter, you know, we sit here talking to you, Luca, our producer's here listening to you, a more amicable, genial bloke you couldn't get, which was the absolute antithesis of the way you played your footy. What was it about crossing the white line that actually set you off?
Look, I think it was Lou Richards who coined the phrase, you know, about me, you know, this kid's got white line fever, and which means something different these days. I think Ben Cousins has got white line fever, hasn't he? But I'm not too sure about that. But that was coined. But Lou also said, he said, you want to meet this kid? He said, when he gets to the footy, he said he takes his head off and puts a pumpkin on and runs out. And he wasn't far off the mark either because, look, I did some stupid things, but...
What was it, Reece? Is it spur of the moment? Have you ever analysed it? What was it that triggered this sort of behavioural pattern that totally went against the way you were off the field?
Early days, it was a matter of, you know, I was a skinny kid. I think I was about 62 kilos in round two, 10 half stone, I think it was, when I first started as a 17-year-old. And I was, you know, just shy of 6'2", I suppose. So I was a skinny kid. And I wasn't going to be pushed around. And back in those days, I mean, clubs would send players out to target you and niggle you and try and put you off the game. And when they realised that I could be upset out there, it become a bit, you know, a bit where it was as much, you know, the opposition out there trying to antagonise you and trying to get you off your game as it was, you know, I didn't want to... And put it this way, I copped better ones than I ever give out there anyway. So it was, just one of those things that, you know, was part and parcel of my footy, and you got to live with it.
Was it important to you to play 100 games for Carlton? Your name's on the locker. You know, which is a great thing, the number 26 locker. And I haven't even asked you why number 26. Well, why did you get that Guernsey? Did you have a choice in it?
No, well, I mean, numbers didn't mean much to me. I mean, well, they meant a little bit, but when I was at South Melbourne in my first year and I broke my leg in my fourth game and so missed the rest of the year. But it was one of those things. I was wearing number 40 then. They said, oh, you know, do you want a lower number and for next year? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And, you know, thinking I might get down in the first 20 or so. And they give me number 30. So I thought, oh, bugger it, I'll just wear number 30. And it didn't worry me too much. And when I got to Carlton, I must admit, I did used to stir Fraser Murphy up a bit because he was wearing the number 30 Guernsey. And so I let him know that, you know, it was part of my contract that I'd be picking up the number 30 Guernsey. And he got pretty angry about it because I kept stirring him. And other blokes would jump on as well and say, what number are you going to be next year, Murph? And he got a bit shirty about it, but numbers didn't mean much to me back then. And 26 was available and... Yeah, I suppose, you know, you make that number your own anyway.
Absolutely. Now, in retrospect, were there regrets? When you look back on your career, do you believe you wrung the cloth dry? Are there things that you would do differently were you to have your time over again?
Too many of them, too many. And that's the thing. It was a different ball game back in our day. It was a completely different ball game. It was more a social... you know, while it was serious and you know, I mean, we drank copious amounts of alcohol, smoked cartons of cigarettes and did all the things you wouldn't want to do. I mean, people talk about performance enhancing these days. I mean, we did the opposite in our days. We did things that make you play worse than what, you know, I mean, we could have been much better, but unfortunately we, but it was great times and life on and off the field. It was fantastic back in those days. It really was. I mean, you're almost rock stars in Melbourne sort of thing. And you'd be out there and all the other players from other clubs, you'd be associating with them. And it was a great time.
In saying that, I suspect that the players of the year in which you played perhaps had more balanced lives. They weren't totally professional. So there was time to play the game, time to work and time to relax. And it seemed to be a pretty level sort of mix.
Yeah, yeah, we all worked. I mean, we all had our, well, not 9 to 5. I mean, we'd be down at training at probably 4:30 start or quarter to 5 start, but that was 3 nights a week. But we, you know, had to hold down a job during the day. So we had a variety of professions and blokes, you know, academics and knuckleheads and whatever. But it was strange. It was a different era, but we enjoyed it. And look, when it came down to the footy side of things, while we enjoyed that social side of things, when it came to playing, we were fair dinkum. I mean, we might have partied hard, you know, on the weekend the week before, but that was all forgotten about. And once you know, they bounced the ball, it was on for young and old.
We're nearing the end of the interview, Reece, but there are a couple of final ones. Do you care to nominate the best Carlton player you saw play in your time and perhaps the best opposition player you encountered over the journey?
Oh, look, I was always amazed by Bruce Steele, and he was just, and I was lucky enough to, you know, in play in his last 2 years. He was just a superstar. I remember, you know, I mentioned before, I grew up barracking for Richmond and had number 4 on me back, and Royce Hart, you know, played on Bruce Steele, and they had some magnificent battles, and both were absolute champions, and to be able to play with Bruce was an honour in itself. Big games, Jono was sensational. He was just an absolute beauty. The bigger the game, the better it was. But and opposition, Gary Ablett always amazed me. He was he could do anything on the footy field. He was a beauty. He could take a mark. You know, he could jump as high as anyone. He could run as fast as anyone. He could kick left foot, right foot. He could do anything. He could hurt players out in the field. He hit them hard. He was tough, so he was a freak, and so, you know, I enjoyed watching him. I didn't enjoy sort of playing on him too much, and I played on him a couple of times. But one of those things. He was a superstar.
And your love for the game, is it still there? The game's changed a lot, and some may argue possibly not for the better. The way that it used to be played, where there was perhaps more influence on individuality and players showing flair. But
yep.
Do you still love the game as much now as you did then?
Yeah, I must admit, going back, I think it was around the mid-90s. It wasn't the mid-90s. It would have been the mid-2000s when the Swans and Eagles were playing those couple of grand finals. And Paul Roos brought in that negative style of football. And football, to me, can't become boring. And I thought, this is the end of footy. This is stuffed footy completely. It really has. And you know, then Geelong come along and were able to beat that, you know, that flooding and that type of game and run the ball through the middle and open it up. And I really do appreciate the players now. I mean, they're magnificent athletes. I'm glad that this drug thing's come up at the moment, because I think it's going to stop this sports science type of thing, because I think they're having a bit too much to say in the way the game's run, rather than football people controlling the game. So let's hope that, you know, we get rid of these sports science nuts who just get in there and say, well, you can train for 37 minutes and that's it, sort of thing. And you're going, Jesus Christ, the blokes might need a flogging today. You know, we'll train over an hour and 37 if we have to, you know, to get the response you need. But, you know, I think there's been a bit too much involvement. I love seeing the best players out on the ground. So the only thing, the only other thing I'd like to see is not as many interchanges, because, you know, I honestly think, you know, there's a few things in footy which is sort of make you cringe a bit, but it probably happened back in the 80s as well. I mean, everyone keeps talking about the old days and that, but there's a lot of blowouts in games and a lot of ordinary games to watch as well. So, I think footy's in a great position. Hopefully they get through this drug saga and people can put things in place to make sure we've got the greatest game in the world. It is just the best spectator sport you'll ever see. And for people to infiltrate it with drugs and so forth, we need to eradicate that side of it. And just, you know, it's such a great game, you know, that it'll live on. It'll keep going. It's fantastic.
And a final question, Reece, which is a question we put to all of our guests. What does Carlton mean to you?
Carlton's where I had some great relationships with people, and I think that's what footy clubs are. I mean, as much as it's success and everything else, you know, I've been able to achieve a lot in my life because of, you know, playing football for Carlton. I mean, it's helped me a lot in, you know, to where I am today. And so, you know, I always think that, you know, I mean, footy clubs don't owe me, you know, or don't owe anyone anything. I mean, we are the footy clubs, and that's probably why, you know, we've got back involved, a few of us, and trying to, you know, help the club at the moment. We've sort of spent a bit of money with the Spirit of Carlton on equipment for the players over the last few years, and hopefully that's helped them. I mean, we you know, really want to see that number 17th premiership land here at Carlton, and it's just it's a great place. It's been, you know, there's been some great people along the way I've had the pleasure to meet and associate with and call my friend, and that's what, you know, footy clubs are all about. And Carlton, you know, is a great part of my life, and if I can give a little bit back in my old age, then I will.
Well, David, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you this side of the white line, always a bonus. Thanks again for giving us your time. It's been fantastic to hear you articulate your thoughts about Carlton and the game itself, and all power to you both for this year and beyond.
And to you, Tony. I really enjoyed this. Lovely conversation.